Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Patrick Sharkey, and today's episode is all about video games. I've spent many hours, as I'm sure many of you have as well, parked in front of a TV or in front of a computer screen, and literally just lose time to the world that you are taken to via video games. On today's show, Max Fuller is going to tell us all about the history of video games. He's going to do it in a matter of 7 minutes or so. It's all very impressive. And then Luke Walchek is going to tell us a little bit about emulations and kind of the renaissance that some of these older games are having through the process of emulation. It's very, very cool. We also get a fun little word on the street. And we hear from Amy, who talked to people on the street about video game characters. So it's a jam-packed show. Feel free to sit back, maybe play this over your headphones while you play a little Mario Kart or something. That's just an idea that I'm giving you for free. All right, on with the show. Video games are a multi-billion dollar industry and is growing every single day. With Nintendo's new console that is both based at home and is portable, plus virtual reality systems are stepping into the mainstream, we are in the midst of one of the most exciting times in gaming history. But where exactly does that history begin? Producer Max Fuller takes us through time for a look at the evolution of gaming from its humble beginnings to the present.
From conquering alien planets in Halo, to wreaking havoc right here in the U.S. in Grand Theft Auto, to racing cars, to catching touchdowns, farm simulations, whatever else your mind can imagine, video games allow us to manifest our wildest imaginations and play them out in the most fun ways possible. For decades now, video games have been tantalizing the minds of kids, adults, and everything in between all around the globe. But, as with many things, rarely ever do we stop and think, where did this all start? How did we get here? In the history of video games, what is level one, if you will? Many people think of 1940 as a year that World War II was in full force in Europe, McDonald's opens its first restaurant, and FDR gets nominated for his third term, but not too many think of it as the year that the first video game was invented. The Nematron was a computer gaming machine designed by nuclear scientist Edward U. Condon in 1940. The machine was designed to play the classical math strategy game NIM and goes down as one of the first attempts at crafting what we would now call a video game. Over the next couple decades, various other computer games that played simple games in a similar way to the Nematron were designed, but it wasn't really until 1968 that gaming began to take shape with the first home video game system, the Magnavox Odyssey.
This is Odyssey, the new electronic game simulator. You attach Odyssey to your television set in seconds to create a closed-circuit electronic playground. Odyssey is tennis, roulette, football and hockey, analogic, and geography.
In 1971, three Minnesota college students created Oregon Trail, the legendary text-based computer game that allows you to assume the role of a 19th century pioneer setting out into the western frontier. You know, minus all the racism and stuff. Just 1 year later, one of the most famous and groundbreaking games of all time bounced its way into the consciousness of people all across the world. While most wouldn't think of two white paddles hitting a ball back and forth on a black screen as groundbreaking, at the time of its release, nobody had ever seen anything quite like Pong. Throughout the rest of the decade, more and more games started to pop up, but gaming was still relatively niche. It wasn't until the 1980s that video games began to have a revolution and become a staple in pop culture. The 80s introduced us to some of the most memorable characters and games that it's hard to even imagine not knowing at this point. From our favorite arcade glutton Pac-Man to the intergalactic warfare of Galaga to the block-bending puzzles of Tetris, the arcade world of the 80s was growing by the second. And not only were arcades becoming more popular, but due to technological advances, gaming was increasingly being brought directly to the homes of the people with gaming consoles like the Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, and Game Boy. And of course, we can't forget that perhaps the single most famous game of all time was released in the 80s. Super Mario Bros. Leapt into our worlds with its side-scrolling, high-jumping plumber named Mario in 1983, and he hasn't left our screens or our hearts since.
Hello, I'm Shigeru Miyamoto, a game developer of Nintendo.
The creator of Mario, Shigeru Miyamoto, is now a legend in gaming lore, but in 1980, he was simply a man with a vision for a new kind of possibility in the world of gaming. There was no game quite like the one Miyamoto imagined, so he decided to create Mario, and the rest is, well, history.
The idea for Super Mario Bros. Was born at a meeting where I presented my desire to create a bigger hero who runs around in a setting with beautiful graphics. We wanted to create a robust Famicom game where large characters move around.
If the 80s were when video games started to grow up, consider the 90s as gaming's puberty phase. The 90s is when we really start to see the gaming world begin to find itself and realize the millions of different ways it can expand. Games like Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, and Final Fantasy VII showed the world how intricate a game could be, that they didn't have to be just some simple screen, but could be entire worlds within themselves. From the blue blurs of Sonic the Hedgehog to the gory violence of Mortal Kombat, gaming was branching out in ways it had never before. With home gaming consoles like the Nintendo 64 and PlayStation 1 becoming increasingly popular, the rise of multiplayer games began, and we even start to see primitive versions of online gaming as early as 1999. It wasn't until the Sega Dreamcast debuted in 2000 that online gaming really began to become a serious component of gaming culture. Although the Dreamcast ended up as a commercial failure, many cite it as the catalyst for the modern-day gaming world we know now. As the 2000s rolled on, the experimentation and expansion of the 90s continued. As technology advanced, games could look more and more graphically beautiful and intricate, and the scope of what a game could be or consist of was changing by the second. With the incorporation of the internet into gaming, almost anything was possible. Over this last decade and a half, gaming has become a multi-billion dollar industry that is ubiquitous throughout the entire world. There are video game shops on every block, dozens of gaming magazines, millions of YouTube channels dedicated to gaming, Major League professional gaming, hell, there's even a Video Game Hall of Fame now. And looking toward the future, it doesn't seem like the gaming world is gonna slow down anytime soon. With virtual reality on the horizon and increased availability in game design technology to everyday people like me and you, the future of gaming looks just as exciting as the past. For the Real College Podcast, I'm Max Fuller.
Hey, this is Bella with Real College Podcast with your question of the week. This week, we asked...
If you were any video game character, who would you be based on your personality?
Does Batman count?
I guess Lego Batman would count.
I'll still go with Lego Batman. Batman's the best superhero.
Ooh, that's a tough one. Probably Link from Legend of Zelda, because then I wouldn't be expected to talk.
Oh, that's a tough one. Guessing it can't be one that's just like a customizable avatar?
No.
Let's go Link from Legend of Zelda if he talked.
If he talked. I just had someone say, only because he doesn't talk.
Oh, really? I feel like I'd fit him pretty well, except I like to talk.
If you were any video game character, who would you be?
Link from The Legend of Zelda.
We have gotten that 3 times already. Why?
Because he's a badass, and I want to be, like, badass back in, like, medieval days, like, fighting people with swords and stuff.
The new Pokemon game's coming out. I feel like I gotta pick a Pokemon or something. You know, let's go, something just crazy. Go with Muk or something.
Why?
I don't know. He's gross. I think it's funny.
Well, I don't know. I guess Geralt from The Witcher, because that's my favorite game so far right now.
Yeah? Do you identify with the character?
Not really. But I wish.
Carmen Sandiego from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? It was a computer game I played when I was 8.
And why would you be Carmen Sandiego?
Because she was this badass criminal that would, like, go to random obscure parts of the country and you would have to track her down, and it was my favorite thing in the world.
Mario. I like to do a lot of exploration, and I like to eat a lot of vegetables, but mushrooms, obviously. And so that helps me get big and strong.
I don't know, probably Faith from Mirror's Edge. I like free running, parkour, carefree and kind of lazy, so.
Yeah, Kratos from God of War.
Why is that?
He is super powerful. He has like some huge weapons that he uses against his enemies.
I would want to be Zelda. She's really cool, and I think, I don't know, my favorite author is also F. Scott Fitzgerald. So definitely that would be very cool to be like Zelda, especially after she was named after his wife.
That was your question of the week. Now back to the show.
Here's a hypothetical situation for you. It's movie night, and your roommate tells you they've never seen Pulp Fiction. Okay, no problem, right? You can just hop on Netflix and stream it. You're already paying for the subscription service, so it doesn't even feel like you've made a transaction. You just get the movie on demand. Now, imagine you don't have a Netflix subscription. What are your options then? Well, you can rent it on Amazon or YouTube for a one-time fee, or you can pick up the Blu-ray at a store, or if you have a copy on DVD or even VHS, you might just settle for that as long as you have a player. The point is, you have a lot of options. If you want to watch a movie, chances are you're going to have some sort of access to that movie. Okay, so here's a different hypothetical. It's game night, and you get it in your head that you want to play the 1989 classic NES platformer Clash of Demon Head. Why not, right? There's just one problem. You don't have an NES, and the game's publisher, Vic Tokai, is now a telecommunications company called Tokai Communications that provides DSL to Japanese customers. They have no interest in reproducing or remaking Clash of the Demon Head. It looks like you're not going to play it, unless you want to spend $70 on an eBay NES and $17 on a card of the game. Or you could take the illegal route and decide to pirate it. Unless you're willing to hunt down an obsolete piece of hardware, there's really no other way to play the game. Now, granted, there's probably a much bigger audience out there for Pulp Fiction than Clash of the Demon Head, but in comparing games to other media, it seems like there's just dead revenue sitting there. If there's a demand for old games, why isn't that demand being satisfied in the same way it is for, say, movies or music?
So, I'm Frank Cifaldi. I like to call myself a video game archivist with a day job.
That job is producing video games for a company called Digital Eclipse, a studio that is devoted to preserving old video games the way that the game makers intended.
The company that I work for, Digital Eclipse, believes in bringing old games back in print and keeping them there because we're way behind movies in that sense.
Digital Eclipse aims to keep these old games in print through emulation, the process of making a computer behave like a different type of computer. Through emulation, games intended for old systems like the NES or Genesis can be reproduced on modern computers and game systems. Emulation is different than simply remaking a game from the ground up because it allows that game to be reproduced exactly as originally intended.
I think it's important that we play the games as they were originally presented because, I mean, the hardware has evolved so rapidly that video games were you know, made specifically for that time period and that hardware. And I think that if you remake an older game and just put, you know, shinier graphics on and higher fidelity audio and ship it out, like, I don't think that usually looks very good. Like, it doesn't hold water as a modern game, and it also tends to miss the point and, to my eyes, typically not look as good as the original game. It's just sort of this weird in between. It's like, I often equate it to colorizing a black and white movie. I think remakes don't respect artistic intent and can't by nature, no matter how hard you work at it. And I think we need to present games exactly as they were and just accept them as they were and move on.
Most major publishers have embraced emulation in one form or another. You can download old PlayStation 2 titles to your PlayStation 4, the Xbox One uses emulation to reproduce Xbox 360 titles, and Nintendo's been selling old games digitally on their system since the Wii's launch in 2006. Emulation is about to hit a massive stride in the mainstream, too. On the 11th, Nintendo will release the Classic Mini NES, a home plug-and-play NES emulator that will feature 30 old games. The problem is that, for many, emulation remains a dirty word because of its association with software piracy. Nintendo itself condemns emulation on their FAQ, stating that emulators created to play illegally copied Nintendo software present the, quote, greatest threat to date to the intellectual property rights of video game developers.
You know, people think emulation is sort of synonymous with, you know, with piracy, with cheap piracy, with free things. And what people don't understand is that emulation isn't piracy. Emulation is a tool. It's an approach to running, you know, older software on newer hardware.
So where's the line?
Is an emulator illegal? No. What makes the process illegal is using intellectual property in the emulator.
Dr. Christopher Terry is an assistant professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota.
Now, in digital copyright, this is a sketchy area because copyright law is quite old. I mean, it's constitutional law. Like, literally, it's Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, right? I mean, it's that old. It really hasn't kept up with the technology. You buy a book, physical book, right? You can read the book, you can use the book, and then you're allowed to transfer ownership of the book for money to yourself. You bought the tangible item. Same book, you buy a digital copy of it, you are not allowed to either sell or even retransmit a copy of that book because the digital law has not kept up. Emulators work the same way. What I see with emulators as a larger issue is it's just a straight issue of intellectual property control.
In other words, emulation isn't illegal. It just enables illegal intellectual property theft.
Companies that have a significant investment in intellectual property also have a significant investment in protecting that property. And what they've created with emulators, the debate over emulators is, if we own it, it's fine. If we don't, it's not, right? And I hate to break it down to that simple, but that's really what you're talking about.
That's fine for large-scale publishers like Nintendo that have the means and ability to reproduce their old games, but a company like, say, Tokai Communications doesn't really have the means nor the intent to reproduce a cult classic like Clash at Demon Head, even if it is somewhat culturally relevant. So what's the future for games emulation? It might be a Netflix-like subscription-based service, powered by game studios devoted to the idea of emulating old games as a means of preservation.
We believe in a future where the industry embraces emulation, makes the equivalent of Nintendo's virtual console station, except for platforms that aren't just Nintendo, and we start getting games, all games, back in print and make them as easy to access as movies are on Amazon. And emulation is the only way to do that, and that's what we're fighting for.
That future starts with separating emulation from software piracy in the public's eye. Until then, games like Clash at Demon Head will reside quietly in our memories. You'll have to settle for this year's Call of Duty on game night. For Radio K, I'm Luke Walachek.
My name is Jacob Maldonado, and I'm here with Word on the Street. On November 7th, Chicago Farmer will be playing at the Cedar Cultural Center starting at 7. The tickets are $12. Chicago Farmers is the name that Cody Dykoff goes by for his band. His music focuses on political and social issues. Here is his song, Queen.
You sit on the roof and talk for hours. Used to dance naked in summer showers. Talking about the good times, been talking of dreams. Used to call her a princess, but now we call her queen. Used to go to parties with no makeup on. She's never silent, she scream out a song. Not a bone in her body, that was me. Used to call her princess, but now we call her queen. We used to make out and roll in the snow. When the summer heat turned to winter cold, her legs would shiver, I'd give her my favorite jeans. Used to call her princess, but now we call her queen.
On November 11th, Communist Daughter will be at First Avenue for their record release party. Tickets are $10 and the show starts at 7. Communist Daughter was founded in Wisconsin but moved to make its home St. Paul. Here is their song, Roll the Stone. And Zulu Zulu will be at the Ice House. Tickets are $7. Zulu Zulu is a collaboration of already established artists in the Twin Cities, and they're getting a lot of media attention here. Here's their song, Fades.
That's all for Real College Podcast this week. Real College Podcast is edited by me, Patrick Sharkey. The show is produced by Max Fuller, Emily LePain, and our two brand new producers. Give it up for Jacob Maldonado Medina and Emily Allen. We're thrilled to have you both on board. My thanks to Luke Walachek, Jacob Maldonado Medina, Max Fuller, and Bella Daly Steele for contributing to today's show. And before we depart, I would be remiss if I did not remind you to get out and vote tomorrow. It's rather important. And to play us out this week, I wanted to play a snippet from an interview that Radio K's morning show, Rock and Roll Over, did last week with U.S. Representative for Minnesota's 5th District, Keith Ellison. Thanks for listening. Have a fantastic week. We're all going to make it. The end is in sight. Stay vigilant.
I was kind of thinking, you know, I know some, I'm going to be honest, I know some people who are thinking about not going out and voting. You know, we all know those people.
Oh, yeah.
And they can be hard to convince. You know, what do we say to those people? What do we say to our friends, our neighbors?
You know, college students especially.
Yeah. College students.
Well, I guess I say to them, look, you get the kind of government that you, in a way, that you deserve, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to participate. You don't want to be involved. Then you're going to get that kind of government, right? And I will say this, you know, the politics have consequences. Elections have consequences. You know, when I went to this school, I'm an alumnus of University of Minnesota, 1990, and I graduated from the law school here in 1990. And when I graduated from law school, I had a grand total of $12,000 in debt. And I borrowed about $4,000 per year. Didn't really, it helped us get along. I got married young, I had kids young. So it helped me focus on studies as opposed to getting another job. But I got through law school, undergrad, and I went to grad school in economics, and I owed a grand total of 12. I know kids picking up $12,000 per semester.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Now, here's the thing. That was a political decision. Some politicians got in a room and decided, we're not going to appropriate the kind of money we used to higher ed. We're going to put it elsewhere. We're going to put it into a tax cut, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these decisions were made, and they can be unmade. It's just a matter of, will the student voice be heard? That's the real issue. I mean, you know, the minimum wage is $7.25. For federal minimum wage is that. Who thinks that's a good thing? I mean, you can't make it on that. So, like, when I went to college, I'm to my undergrad, I mean, with a summer job and a little extra little job during the year, I kind of got out of there in a scholarship here and there. I got out of there debt-free.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it seems almost impossible. You need a parentship. That's the alternative to a scholarship. Or you need some sort of, I don't know what you get, but if you don't have parental support, or you don't have somehow your own money, you're going to end up with a big fat debt load. And that's bad for you, but that's bad for our society too, because we need you when you're 21, 25, 26, you know, buying a house, forming a household. We need you getting your own car, because that old beater you've been riding around in probably need to be switched out. But you're not going to have any money because you're paying student debt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is bad for the economy. 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer debt. I mean, not consumer debt, is consumer spending. And if the students, young people, have all this debt load, that cuts into consumer spending, which slows down our economy. So it's bad for everyone. And I think that we can change it if we put the right people in place.